We are here on really the eve of the 44th Parliament. We have, as we begin this discussion, already some lessons learned to help guide us, lessons about preparedness in this country. We saw many supply chains that stopped working, leaving us empty-handed. Outsourcing to countries like China and others left us vulnerable, even on necessities such as masks and pharmaceuticals. And then, of course, there are the unintended consequences of the support program that proved proved disincentives for some to return to work. We are here today under the auspices of Government Analytics. Greg and Steve are the guys that crunch the numbers. They give their clients a competitive edge by making sense of complicated data sets. So thank you for setting the stage for us. What we are going to try to do today is figure out what that data means. And fortunately, we have with us two pretty smart guys to help us figure this all out. Dr. Jack Mintz, an economist, has spent decades influencing public policy at all levels of government. He is currently a fellow with the Public Policy School at the University of Calgary and was recently chair of the Premier's Economic Recovery Council in Alberta. He's also an active contributor to the National Post. And as I can attest, he appears regularly before parliamentary and Senate committees. So thank you very much, Jack, for being with us. Dr. David Dodge, of course, an economist as well, with a hands-on impact on public policy for many decades as Deputy Minister of Health and Deputy Minister of Finance. But his impact was most direct as Governor of the Bank of Canada. He was in the chair just as the 08 crisis was about to begin. David is currently a senior advisor with the law firm Bennett Jones. So thank you both very much for taking this time. I want to start, if I can, right with the numbers. Expected deficit for 2021, $3.43 billion, up from $34 billion. Net federal debt by March 2021, $1.2 trillion, up from $765 billion. Lost revenue due to COVID, $81.3 billion. David, are these numbers as serious as they sound?
The numbers are big. We have not witnessed this sort of situation pretty much in our lifetime. We've not witnessed it. We had, with COVID, we had a supply shock of enormous magnitude around the world, which transformed itself very quickly into a demand shock. And it's those two shocks that governments have been trying to deal with since the beginning of this year. They've largely been trying to deal with it through additional spending, both to support incomes and to support jobs, to work our way through this period. And we're not out of the woods yet. So governments will continue to do this, both here in Canada and around the world. That will leave us and not just governments, but it's going to leave firms and many households with additional debt. And so the issue then looking forward is what are the policies that governments ought to be following? First, as we pursue this last year or next year or 18 months of working our way out of the immediate shock and then carrying on after that. So there are both structural issues and there are quantum issues, if you will. And it's not just governments, it's also monetary authorities, central banks. What are they going to do? And I think that's basically in the end what we're going to be discussing this morning. But I'd just like to start off by bringing it back home here to Canada for a moment and saying that coming into the crisis, and really since the great financial crisis of 2008-2009, we were developing some significant structural problems in this country, and that largely was showing up as a deficit, a rising deficit in our current account, i.e. we were selling less to the world than we were buying. And so in the end, we were borrowing from the rest of the world. Secondly, it showed up as very low rates of investment in this country, in absolute terms, but also very much in relative terms. It showed up that Canadian firms indeed were more willing to invest offshore than they were here in this country. And it has showed up that we end with a rather large deficit on fees and royalties from the use of intellectual property. We've not been very good at developing that. And so as governments work through the rest of this COVID period, there ought to be a focus, if you will, on doing the things that in the end will begin to correct or at least ameliorate some of those problems which I just enumerated that have been building up. In many ways, one of those problems is that Canada had been rather slow to adopt to the digital world. Both governments, businesses, and households had been slow. And so one of the very good things that may be coming out of COVID is that it is prompting us all to realize that we live in a digital world and to make the investments and corrections needed to get there, both in terms of workers and individuals and in turn their training and their education, in terms of our resource sector, which is extraordinarily important, in terms of application of technology, and very importantly, in terms of government services, health, education, justice, all of which were lagging far, far behind where we should have been in the use of digital technology. Our regulatory system, which has been badly broken, and in infrastructure, where we have failed both for the transport of goods and services and people, but most importantly, we've denied large parts of the country the digital infrastructure to allow people and businesses to participate in the world. So we really need to keep those in mind as we think about what we're doing on the monetary and fiscal policy side.
Okay. Well, I think I want to get into the prescriptions in just a moment, so just hold that thought, but I want to have Jack respond and join us just on the numbers about where we are, debt deficit. I've laid out the federal numbers, but there's also provincial numbers that concern you, I know, as well, Jack.
Thank you very much. First of all, you're probably not going to hear much disagreement between David and I. In fact, David and I first worked together at the Department of Finance in 1984 to 1986, when we kept on telling ministers, you need to worry about debt and deficits. And David, we know how long that took as an exercise until it finally got through in 1994-95. And so we're back at this point, and we remember the scars of those years and what it meant to the country. So I agree with a number of things that David said, but let me try to go through a little bit of numbers that are somewhat different, just to give you an idea about the size of the deficits and the debt that is currently happening. If you include the latest announcements, the federal deficit, and we really won't know the final number until the end of March of 2021, but they are approaching, $400 billion when you include the latest announcements. So that's a pretty large amount. And the provincial deficits officially are roughly $85 billion, but you can almost say that we're getting close to $500 billion in deficits this year. And that is literally 25% of GDP. And if you look at Canada, that's actually on the high side amongst countries. Maybe the United States is trumping us in to use a pun. But certainly it is by far much larger. So I put some numbers together based on the International Monetary Fund, which is a little different than the official Canadian public accounts numbers. This is based on IMF data, which excludes government pension plan deficits, etc. But if you look at gross debt, and many people argue that, you know, when you get into stringent times, net debt numbers are not as interesting because of valuation issues around non-assets and the fact that many assets are especially intangible or tangible assets like highways and roads are not exactly easily liquidated when you need to cash in and use money that because you're having difficulty selling bonds to the international market. But if you look at the gross debt number as of June 2020, according to the IMF, consolidated government debt is now 109% of GDP, which gets us back pretty closer and closer to where we were in 1994, although we do have much lower numbers today. That is higher than Germany, which is 77% of GDP, and also higher than United Kingdom at 102% of GDP. And I always like to look at Australia because it's a resource-based economy like us and very similar to us in many ways. They are at 60% of GDP. So our numbers are kind of not too bad because it's far worse in places like Japan and United States. But those are big countries that are that have sovereign currencies that are highly demanded for safety reasons by international investors. And so they're two very different cases that are not really comparable to smaller countries.
But in the middle of a pandemic, is the debt to GDP ratio still a valid anchor, still a valid point of comparison when we know that the spending is just...
I'm saying is that this already includes some of the spending that happened in 2020. I think the main point is that we have, you know, countries have taken on debt for reasons that David clearly enunciated, which is, you've had a major supply and demand shock and governments are trying to bridge the economy to when you get back to recovery. And the issue, though, I think, is not simply that you had to take on debt, but how much debt and how well you actually spent your money. And Canada has actually spent quite a bit, so much that actually personal incomes went up in Canada because of all the money that was poured out because government transfers actually were more than actually the losses in income that people had. So I think that's something to remember.
We actually have people talking about using these support programs to pay down their debt. So clearly there were other issues there.
Right, but the question is how you design those support programs and how far you go down the road, and we can go into some debate about that. But my main point is that the gross debt numbers were kind of middling. In fact, the average amongst all advanced countries is 122% of GDP. We're just a little bit below that. So what I'm trying to say is that we've used some of the firepower that we created by our very good fiscal management that took place from 1995. Until going up to up until about 2015, 2016, we started running bigger deficits, but not too large. So we're still pretty good financing, but that firepower can very quickly disappear if we don't do it right. I also looked at net debt using IMF, but there's some real serious issues about the treatment in Canada of CPP and QPP. Which are treated as net assets and future benefits are excluded as a liability. And so we tend to underestimate really our net debt if we believe that those assets should be used to pay for our future pension plans. And as a result, we may be taking a little bit too much comfort in net debt numbers and we really should. But if you include, and I took these IMF data on unfunded liabilities associated with both pensions and healthcare costs, our total public debt, net debt plus unfunded liabilities is a little over 101% of GDP. So not too bad. In fact, that's about half of what the number would be for advanced countries around the world. So on that side, we do look pretty good still. And the question then is, if we ran deficits of, a couple hundred billion dollars every year for the next 5 years, that would quickly erode really our advantages that we've had.
I want to raise that very point, because what we're hearing talked about in lots of circles is this whole question of modern monetary theory. I'm not sure that it is a theory, but I want to hear from both of you. It's simply put, it's just keep on spending. Just spend. That debts and deficits aren't that important, and we can just do that because we can print more money to fund it. David Dodge, former governor of the Bank of Canada, what do you say to this?
Those words, modern monetary theory, are not a very good description of what's going on here. So what is going on? And let's just take Canada and the United States, because in both of our countries, we have central banks, which essentially have been running policy aimed at hitting an inflation target of 2%. In so doing, at the present time, they are running policy interest rates of very close to zero, the lowest, in fact, they can go in practical terms. And they are buying bonds to keep longer rates down. And then why are they doing that? They're doing that for the very sensible reason that we have a deficiency of aggregate demand at the moment. Holding rates down is there to encourage both corporate borrowing and investment and personal borrowing and consumption. So that's why they are doing it. Does it make sense? The answer is, as long as you're trying to hit a 2% deficit target, it certainly makes sense. And if indeed we're going to have a deficiency of aggregate demand for a period of time, undoubtedly those interest rates will stay rather low for a period of time. If we look at the period since the great financial crisis, those interest rates have averaged about 1.5%, between 1 and 1.5% below the growth rate of the economy, right? And so that means the debt that is building up under those circumstances, in a sense, doesn't accumulate more because interest rates are less than growth rates. And so if we were planning, that there could be growth rates in the future of about what we had in the last 10 years, and interest rates of about what we had in the last 10 years, essentially we could run government deficits of roughly 1% of GDP a year, without the debt sort of building up. So that's kind of the limit. To the extent we're running more than that, then indeed we're building liabilities that future generations will have to deal with. And that means in the future that service payments as a share of government revenues are going to go back up, and not to the level of that Jack and I had to deal with back in 1994-95, when it was over 30% of GDP, over 30% of government revenues were going to interest payments. But nevertheless, they are going to go back up. And so governments really have to plan that's going to happen. And that, in fact, creates the limit, if you will, to how much governments can go out and continue to borrow year after year.
Well, that's the issue. If in this modern theory, and Jack, please jump in here, that they don't want to borrow in the private capital markets and engage. They just want the Bank of Canada to become the printing machine, and therefore they're not subject to the same restraint that you have to do if you're trying to raise money in the private sector, in the capital markets. So then you've really got a problem, because how do you contain the inflation growth if there's nobody pushing back saying, hold on, we're not gonna lend you anymore, if it's just the bank continues to print it, Jeff?
Well, I think, these are the risks that are involved. I mean, I agree with David on the fact that at the current period, we're going to have a very slack economy. There's going to be room for expansion and deficits without triggering more inflation. But we do have to remember that these things do get reversed. One of the things that kind of bothers me is that people keep on talking about the fact that interest rates are less than growth rates, and therefore we can afford running deficits for a very long time. We have to remember that 2020, actually the opposite has occurred. We're going to have GDP growth at minus 6.2%, and we have interest rates, even if the government 10-year bond rate is just a half percentage point. That's a difference of close to 7%. Where interest rates are now well above growth rates this year. And so when you start doing averaging, that certainly is going to have an impact when you start thinking about that. So, growth will come back. There's a very interesting IMF paper that just came out recently showing that overall, even though interest rates might be lower than growth rates for a period, over time they do revert back to the basic long-term relationship that interest rates tend to be higher than growth rates over time. And so we will eventually get back to that point, but we will also, because of the supply shock, as we increase demand, the key is whether, and this is where the productivity issue comes in, the structural issues come in, that if we don't improve our supply side of the economy, that could end up setting up inflation. We also have to remember that investors get worried about governments when they have high amounts of deficit spending or bonds that have to be issued to the market, and they may get nervous whether the country is going to have that ability to do so. And as David pointed out, Canada actually has a bad current account surplus. In fact, it's in 2021, it's forecast to be minus 3.6% of GDP. That, by the way, is higher than any other country except for the UK amongst the G7. And in fact, you look at Germany, they're running current account surplus at 4.7%. Canada also has the public debt, there's a very short term structure, term for government bonds. It's only 5.4 years, which is less than any of the other countries. And our gross financing needs for 2020 is 22% of GDP. That's for governments, for the central government to fund its bonds. The risk becomes when international investors start thinking a country is not going to be able to pay back its debt. And that's what causes interest rates to rise up, not just inflation, but credit spreads. And you could really see that happening actually for some of the bad cases during the COVID problem. I have some numbers here just to give you an idea. Italy's sovereign credit risk spread increased from 53 points in February of this year to 196.7 points by May. That's a 1.5 increase in interest rates just in 2 months' time. Argentina went up from 1,247 basis points to 2,978 basis points, and then they reneged on their debt in August. And so you could see that the countries that really start looking like they're having problems, you can get very sharp increases in interest rates. And the final point I want to make is about inflation. If it starts rising, and this won't happen for a while, when it starts rising, even from what we're now pretty close to zero or maybe 0.5% in core inflation rate, if it goes up to 2%, we have to remember that's going to worsen the government deficit at the federal level, because transfer payments are indexed to inflation. Personal income tax brackets are indexed to inflation, so the revenues won't grow as much. And we also know that wage demands will probably go up with inflation too for the public sector. And so when you put all that together, that will actually, with this extraordinary amount of more debt that we've taken on, you add on another 0.5% interest rates on that debt, which is now over $1 trillion and rising, then that's going to widen the deficit a bit further. Not as severe as what we saw back in 1995 when you have those risks, but the risks are still there.
I want to try and get from both of you and focus it in on where we are today. David was starting at that point about what some of the measures may be, what we may see from government versus what we actually need. So we've heard in the last few weeks, the government has your back, and so we will spend as long as we need to. I think to quote David Dodge on that, there were the letters B and S in response to that. I read somewhere that you had said so that it's not the government that has your back, it's future generations that have your back. So that's there. We're hearing about a reimagined Canada, that every step of the recovery must be greener than green. We've heard about taxes on principal ownership, on principal homes. We've heard about a new carbon tax of $350 a ton. There are a whole lot of a guaranteed annual income is the other thing that that they have talked about. Will each of you pick a couple of those things that concern you and talk to us about it? And David, I'll start with you.
Well, as I started saying, Pam, what we can't eat what we don't produce in the end. And so the emphasis really has to be on production. We can't go on borrowing from the world, as Jack has just cogently said. There's a big problem in that. You can borrow if you're increasing your production, which is the Australian case. It's very difficult to go on borrowing in order to fund consumption, which has been more recently the Canadian case. So indeed, thinking about what governments ought to be doing, it really is to do those things that will increase our capacity to produce and to produce those products and services that the world wants to buy from us. And this is a big challenge. Let me start there. It is a big challenge. We've relied on our exports of natural resources in the last 10 years, basically, to cover a much worsening position on everything else that we do. So where indeed should we start? So let me come right home to say, what ought we to do about government sector? Government sector is about 25% of GDP in this country in terms of what we actually produce. That's the health, education, justice, infrastructure, and all of that sort of stuff, right? Well, we are very inefficient in the way we do it. And in particular, in all of those areas, we've been particularly retrograde in our ability to apply digital technology. And that is certainly something that government can be doing through this period, is bringing that forward. In the health sector, to make use of the data to improve the quality of delivery. In education, we really ought to be able to deliver online services appropriately. It is doable. Justice is in the 19th century in the way it operates. It hasn't even got into the 20th century. There's big room to maneuver. In infrastructure, both for the movement of goods and for the movement of people, again, we've been failing to invest. But probably even worse, we've been failing to invest in the movement of electrons to move those around so that throughout the country, whether you live in the center of a big city or whether you live on the fringe of a big city or whether you live in a rural area, you have access to it. Business can't develop without that. People can't develop without that. And finally, I would like to leave with a very important point in terms of how we legislate and how we regulate. It is very hard for business to make investment when they are highly uncertain about the evolution of that regulation, highly uncertain about how courts are going to interpret it. And so you cannot, as a government, as governments, you cannot create that degree of uncertainty and expect business to take on the normal business risk, but then take on the risk of government moving in a very uncertain way. Government can be, if you will, tough in its regulation, but it can't keep moving it around so that people don't know what they're up against.
I think
we've got a long way to go on that front. And those are things that government can do within its own sphere, the 25% of the economy that it has, and how it affects the other 75% of the economy by the way it regulates and legislates.
Okay, Jack, to you on that, and to respond to that, because if we're talking about Bill 69 and the uncertainty of what it means and will it be challenged in courts, the same with carbon taxes, although I know you support it to a certain degree. I would be shocked to find out you supported a $350 a ton new tax added onto this, but surprise me if you will. What are we going to see, or is there just too much uncertainty here to even know? Do you have any sense of where we're headed?
I think, first of all, we have to remember, by the way, I hope everything's okay, because I think we're having some, Pamela, you kind of froze for a bit there.
Oh, anyway. Did I? Okay. Did you hear what I asked?
Yeah, I've heard most
okay,
of it.
Great.
I think I'm okay. Let me first of all say that we have, a lot of the things that David said, I totally agree with, and I don't want to repeat it, but I just...
Okay, now we've got you frozen a little bit here, Jack, so let's just wait a moment. Jack, I don't know if you can hear us, but you have frozen. Nope.
After my exhortation about the importance of digital
technology, believe me, and we're all way too far behind in terms of doing this. So I think Jack is going to try and reestablish contact with us. So let's just carry on, David. I think we can just carry on with that discussion.
Sure.
What's your sense of what we're going to get? I mean, we are looking at a throne speech. We don't have a budget date, but what are two things or three things that the government must do if it's going to discuss, if it's going to deal
I'm
with?
I'm back now.
Oh, you're
guys, back.
Okay, so we'll let Jack answer the other, and then we're going to come back to some very...
David's point about digitization is so important. Maybe we still have some...
You just wanted to highlight that for us, yeah.
But let me just say, before I answer the question about the resource sector, which I think is a critical part of Canada, I mean, digitization is really important. I totally agree with everything David said. But as I once said at a panel meeting, I can't eat a digital hamburger. So you also have to produce goods. And Canada is very good at that with a lot of resources. But one of the big issues we've really struggled with for decades is productivity. And in fact, since 2015, we've had no increase in output per working hour in Canada. It's been flat, virtually flat. And this is really quite concerning, because as a long-term trend, that's a real structural issue. And that goes back to issues like the ones that David said about, for example, improving the efficiency of government, because it has a big impact on productivity. But also how governments treat investment, which has also declined in almost every sector except for residential real estate. That's the only thing that's grown since 2015 in real terms. Machinery and equipment, research and development, exploration and development, all of it is down from where we were in 2014. And so we really have a big challenge in improving both investment and improving government efficiency. And why? Because we need to do that in order to increase supply in the economy. And this gets to the point about the energy transition. We are going to have an energy transition this century, for sure. And it is going to happen over the next several decades. However, we have to remember that that despite all the intentions of, let's say, governments wanting to get to net zero emissions by 2050, they all rely on technologies that we don't know yet work or are commercial yet. Or they could actually end up being very high costs.
Or that are fueled by the traditional sources.
Right. And so when you look at, and I've read, you know, International Energy Association, plans, clean, you know, low carbon plans and other ones, and they all rely on things like carbon absorption from the air or carbon capture and sequestration, or they rely on the adoption of electric vehicles, trucks, hydrogen, all these things. And it may happen, and we may end up with battery storage, but we don't know yet. And so technology is going to be the big answer to that. And the big question is, can Canada actually be one of those major sources of technology? And we do have an advantage in terms of having a very significant energy sector that operates in Canada and have a lot of smart people working in the field that could help develop those technologies. So I think that will be a long-run goal for us. But then the question is, how do we get there at the least cost, economic cost, without bearing the economy? And economists like myself have argued in the past for carbon pricing, either a cap and trade system or a carbon tax. I'm actually sometimes more in favor of cap and trade systems because than carbon taxes, but it doesn't matter. They both have one virtue, and that is you don't pick the technologies. You don't pick what's the best way of trying to deal with the energy transition. You just put a price on, and the market will respond to the incentives of trying to reduce the cost associated with carbon pricing by developing the technologies that can reduce it. And if it would mean significant revenue for the governments, it could be used in various ways. Frankly, rebating is the worst way because it's just giving money back to people without changing their behavior, without changing the economy. It would be better if we could use that money. In fact, even if we used it as, you know, significant tax credits or grants for finding new technologies, I'm fine with it. I think it's better doing that than simply just rebating it to people. But we do need a major discussion about our carbon approach. And the $350 carbon tax you're talking about, that's a clean fuel standard, which is currently being discussed in the federal government. And that is the one that could be potentially used to force up the price of diesel and gasoline so much that it would push people more into electricity and hydrogen. That's the concept. Mm-hmm. But is that actually the best way of approaching our policy? And it also gets back to, do we believe that the oil and gas sector can be a significant part of the overall growth strategy for the country as we move to this low carbon society? And my view is that oil and gas will play a role. Even under the IEA forecasts of zero net emissions, oil and gas remains a significant part of the fossil fuel or the energy equation.
Right.
We also have to remember that oil provides plastics, and plastic demand is about 20% of oil demand. And we also have to remember that oil reserves are going to deplete over the next 30 years. And in fact, with the proven reserves we have today, only 20% of them will be available by 2050 to deal with any demand there is for oil. So even if the demand for oil drops from, let's say, 90 or 100 million barrels per day worldwide to 60 or 50, we won't have enough reserves unless the industry is investing in finding new reserves. And so when you start putting that all together, there's still a role, an active role for the oil and gas industry. It may not be a big growing one. It may not be our fastest one. But then if it's investing in
fuel the green, the movement toward green. I was saying to David when we had some technological glitches, and I think it does reinforce that, living in rural Saskatchewan, I know how huge an issue this is for all of us, that if we're going to live and work remotely and virtually, we need the technology. But I want to talk about some of the things that are on the horizon potentially, or some of the things that should be. When you look at something, we're talking about a new carbon tax and raising the price yet again on something very fundamental for consumers, the cost of driving a car or heating their home or cooling their home. Some parts of Canada, we've got household debt that was over $2 for every dollar of disposable income. So this is a serious situation that we're in. And as we see effects of these kinds of decisions, on what it means to a household budget, we have to consider that. Then we have heard from government and other sources things like an extension of what we've been seeing with the programs through COVID, something like a guaranteed annual income, reduce all the other different kind of payments program and have one single base income for the wealthy. It can be taxed back. Are any of these things in either of your minds realistic must-dos? David, I'm going to come back to you. If there are two things that you want the government to do in this throne speech and budget, what are they?
So let's go back to where Jack and I both are. We've got to increase our capacity to produce, but we can't distribute in the end what we don't actually produce. And so that in my mind, really has to be the focus. Now, there's a big problem in some sectors of the economy with COVID. I mean, we have decimated the tourism economy. We've decimated the travel economy. And so we have to think very hard about how we handle that. And it seems to me these are important sectors going forward, and we ought to be using this period of time to train in that sector, to make investments in people in that sector, to use people in that sector to do some of the other things we need to do in the economy, but not just to shovel out cash, because we actually need the production that these people represent. And if it's not at this moment in time in those sectors, then let's prepare for the future when it will be there and use those resources, those people, to produce things we need to produce at the moment. So to me, thinking only about the distribution side is an enormous mistake. We need to be thinking about how we can use this period of time where we are going to have people in those sectors that are not fully employed, and where we're going to have entrepreneurs in those sectors that are not fully employed because of this constraint that's on because of COVID. Let's use the time to increase their productivity in the future. And I think that's really important, because this is not a general situation. If you look at what's happened, we've got sectors, individual sectors that have been decimated through this, and there's lots of the economy that is doing fairly well. Indeed, as you pointed out earlier, savings rates are at their absolute all-time high in the household sector here at the moment, not just because of government transfers, but simply because we haven't been able, people like us haven't been able to spend as much on things we might otherwise do. So that's what we really have to think about. This is not the time to be thinking about grand new social designs. It is the time to be thinking about improving the productivity in our health sector, improving the productivity in our education sector. And in those sectors that have been decimated, making those investments in people so that, in fact, they can be more productive, perhaps in the short run, but certainly in the longer run.
But investments in people, you don't mean just sending a check. You're saying retrain, educate, move, something very different.
I mean, people in the hospitality sector.
Correct.
I mean, one of the things in the short run is we lack the ability to deal with long-term care. We lack the ability. We can use people. We can train people in that area, which we know is going to be an ongoing demand going forward. So let's think about the future. Use this time when people are not fully employed in those sectors to build a resource that will enable us to be more productive in the future.
Okay, Jack, I'm going to come to you. Is there one or two things government must, should do or not do as we head into this period of throne speech, budget, and who knows what on the COVID front?
Well, just as a general principle, I think that, this year we're dealing with this pandemic, and that's going to happen over the year. But I think what the key issue is to focus completely on growth. As recovery, that's the principle for recovery. And so David and I are exactly the same view that we have to increase productive capacity. But let me give a nice simple example. There's some easy things that I think we should be doing. For example, Canada's way behind in 5G. Why are we way behind in 5G? Because we have mucked up the spectrum allocation. And in fact, moving much faster on digitization. In fact, by the way, Australia is already several years ahead of us because they've done it better. But we need to start paying attention to this is an example of regulations that is impeding our ability to growth. The government should be focused on getting 5G going and should be dealing quickly with the spectrum issue and allocating it. It would also be very good for broadband. Broadband is very difficult in the rural areas because of the cost. But there are new technologies, satellite technologies, that could deliver broadband to rural technologies that are better. But again, we're going to need the technologies to do that. The government should be focused on these things. And these are this is the kind of policy that we need to get going in terms of this country in order to move it ahead. So to me, the whole focus should be on things like innovation, digitization, moving further along the energy transition in a smart way, not in a dumb way. And those are the things that I think the speech from the throne should be talking about. It should not be talking about giving out more money to people, and redistribution, because you can't redistribute what you don't have. And so we really have to build that productive capacity up for the country.
I want to just focus in on this point that you've both raised. And I've heard this in conversations with business leaders across this country. They are not going to invest in this country in terms of expanding their own plants and operations until they know what the bigger plan is and until there is some sense of control on regulation. Where are we headed? So they know what climate they're going into. But the other issue is no investment coming from outside. What signal needs to be sent in order to start to turn that around?
David? So Pam, let me start, though, reminding people. We always talk about outside. We got to look at what we ourselves are doing. And I think this is very interesting. Non-residential fixed investment in Canada over the last decade, from 2010 to 2019, is up about 25% in real dollar terms. If I compare that to what's happened to where Canadian businesses is investing, Canadian direct investment abroad is up 275% over that period of time. So while we've invested 25% more in ourselves, we've turned around and invested an extra 175% abroad. I mean, it's our own selves have decided that we're not the right place to make investment. Well, until we can turn that around so that our own companies and ourselves are wanting to invest here, we've got a problem.
But hasn't COVID shone the spot on that, which is, yes, people were moving investment dollars and building plants. And then all of a sudden we figured out, because we outsourced so many jobs and manufacturing of products to other countries, then in the middle of COVID, it doesn't, you know, whether it's PPE or masks or pharmaceuticals or toilet paper, we couldn't even supply ourselves because we were so susceptible to the, you know, being just too far down the list. So what does that mean? Is our response then have to be America first, Canada first, much more domestic oriented products? Can you really bring manufacturing home and create all of that within our own borders? Is that even realistic?
Well, first of all, you've got to make the climate for investment in Canada more receptive, right? And if it's not receptive to our own folks, I mean, why can we expect it to be receptive to people from abroad? So, I mean, we've got a big hill to climb here to deal with that problem. And that indeed was exactly what Jack was talking about in the resource sector. And it's the resource sector, whether it's oil and gas, it's the resource sector, whether it's mining or agriculture. It all requires the same sort of effort in order to make investment in those sectors attractive.
Could I just add something here, which if David broke down his numbers between 2011 and 2019, or 2010 and 2019, you would find that actually investment, that 25% increase of investment primarily took place before 2015.
It did, and was in oil and gas.
But in all sectors, actually, I've done this. You know, every sector except for residential real estate since 2014 has declined relative to 2014. Manufacturing, trade, I can go through the whole gambit. And we do have a big hill to climb, and it's not that it isn't a matter of outsourcing, Pamela. Only there has been some of that, no question, but it's just simply that people do not see the returns doing that. I've looked at a lot of the sectors. Just taking oil and gas as an example, do you know that U.S. investment and employment in oil and gas went up from 2015 to 2019? It went down in Canada. And as anyone will tell you in the oil patch, money moved out of Canada and went elsewhere. People are going to other places, whether it's foreign money coming into Canada that used to come in, or whether it's Canadians that are investing abroad. We also know that we have lost a number of very wealthy people and their tax base that have left Canada. I can give, and I won't do this here, but I know personally 8 or 9 people who are no longer residents of Canada that have basically taken out billions of dollars in tax base out of Canada. And so we need to worry about making sure that we are attractive for young people to come here. And as we have to remember, our dollar also devalued, which means that our salary levels have dropped relative to the United States. That's been good in some senses, because why Amazon and others are setting up labs in Canada is because we educate very smart engineers to come out of university, and they could be paid $75,000 American in Canada, or even less. But if they bring them down to the United States, they end up paying over $100,000.
Yeah.
So we're starting to see some of that gap opening up again. And that's why we have to really worry about making sure that we can get some growth in this country, because what it could mean is actually eventually in getting into the same kind of problems that we started seeing back in the 1990s and the 1980s when we were having difficulty driving up investment and productivity. In fact, the period 1989, 1999, we were fourth lowest in the OECD in terms of labor productivity. And there were a number of reasons for that, but we have to be very careful, and we have to really get back onto the onto thinking about growth and driving up private investment in this country. It's not just going to be government spending that's going to create wealth in this country.
I want to ask you both one final question, and then we're getting participation questions coming in, and we're going to let people ask some of their questions live to you. But just as we close our part of this discussion today, I want you to think about trends. What we figured out is that we can all get our prescriptions renewed without going into a doctor's office. We can do that online. We have seen real estate dramatic.
Except the doctor has to use fax machine to move the prescription. I mean,
very good point, David. They do. I'm on airplanes even still more than I want to be. And my expectation now and going forward, and I was speaking with a flight attendant on a plane who's been around for a while too. I now want to again expect to have a little room to sit in a plane. I want it to be clean and I want the air to be changed. So can that continue on? Is there an economic model that's going to happen? We've seen fundamental changes in real estate behavior, people moving to smaller towns, selling the big pile of bricks in the city for lots of money, changing lifestyles, people looking for yards so their kids can function. What is the one trend that you think is good and will help us, or the one trend that you think is very troubling that we should be trying to stop in its tracks? David, I'll go to you first.
Let me start with a troubling trend.
Don't you?
a troubling trend. If we look at where we've been investing, you know, one of the most important investments is in software, is in the intangibles. The intangible sector is indeed the growth sector for the world, and it's going to have to be, it's going to have to be for us. If we look at what we've done since 2010, we've barely begun to increase our investment in software and intangibles. From a little bit, maybe from about 14 or 15 or 16 or 17 billion in 2010 to maybe 20 billion this year. Almost no increase. If we look at the rest of the world, and here I'll just pick the U.S. and this one, they've gone from roughly 200 billion to 450 billion investment over that same period of time. So about five times faster than what we've been doing, right? But this is what generates these great returns. And what do we find when we look just at the current account? We find that our payments to foreigners for licensing, that sort of software and intellectual property, is $9 billion more than what we receive for what we produce. I mean, this is an area I'm afraid that we've lagged behind in. And it's very unfortunate because, as Jack said earlier, we do have the smart people. We just got to capitalize on it. And that means providing the right environment for business to be able to capitalize on it.
Jack, a trend that's troubling or positive?
Well, I do think that we are going to be seeing some rapid change. I before COVID happened, I thought that this decade, we are going to see some very significant changes in business, and it's all going to be digital and or related to new technologies, whether it's robotics, artificial intelligence, or whatever. And it's happening, and it was happening fast in the United States before COVID, and it's been very slow in Canada. And so, and then, by the way, it's important to every sector. It's important to the resource sector. It's important to the services sector. It's important to the manufacturing sector. It really pervades the whole economy. And you need to have the right incentives there. But if we do not pay more attention to private investment and making sure we drive up private investment, which includes intangibles, just generally creating the atmosphere, this will be, I think, the thing I worry about the most. As far as the changes that are going to occur in the use of that technology, of which we're now seeing with Zooming and that we're using right now, that will have some impact, I think, especially in the large cities. like Toronto and Vancouver, Montreal, maybe Calgary and Edmonton, but particularly in large cities. Why? Because there's a lot of time wasted with commuting.
Yeah.
And if people can operate without having to go into office every day, but could do it maybe some days and not every day, then that's going to be especially in the technology areas and some others, then I think we're going to see urban cities are going to have more difficulty with their core. And it does have implications for things like public transit and how you fund public transit. So some of those things we will have to see as they develop over time, how much that grabs. But the key to any society is flexibility and to be able to meet those challenges, because things will change all the time, as we've seen this past year. You can get tremendous change occurring. And what makes a society operate really well is its ability to adapt to new changes and to protect the vulnerable that could be most affected by it. I think that's going to be the challenge that we're going to have as a country, because I think our inflexibility at times has actually made it more difficult for us to deal with these new changes, unlike what we often see, especially south of the border.
Yeah, I think we do, and we also haven't seen the putting economics aside for a sense. We haven't seen the psychological impacts of how we're living and living Zooming and not having the kind of human touch. I was saying to somebody yesterday, as I read this on Twitter, what are we going to do with the generation who've been homeschooled by day drinkers? We've got some issues that we may just have to deal with coming up. All right, I want to invite some people to ask their questions, and very patiently, Senator Elizabeth Marshall from Newfoundland. I think, Elizabeth, you have a question for Dr. Mintz.
Yes, can you hear me, Pamela?
Yes, that's great.
Yeah, so I have one for Dr. Dodge and one for Dr. Mintz. Who shall I go first?
Mintz.
Go ahead. Go to Dr. Mintz on the Crown Corporation issue.
Yeah, Dr. Mintz, yeah. I'm on Senate Finance Committee, and one of the issues I've been looking at is the role of the Crown Corporations and tracking, you know, their involvement in the COVID-19 programs and even before that. And I haven't seen, much commentary on the Crown Corporations, but some of them are very big into different lines of business. For example, CMHC, mortgage insurance, and you look at Export Development Corporation. Now they're lending out a lot of money, which they think they're going to get back. Have you ever looked at that, or do you have any comments on it? I get concerned when I start looking at CMHC and Export Development Corporation. I'm wondering if you have any views on the activities of the Crown Corporations at this time.
Well, to be honest, I haven't looked at it for a few years in terms of, the Crown Corps, especially in finance and what they're doing. But we do have to recall that they do tend to take on somewhat riskier portfolios, thinking especially EDC and BDC, than you would find in the private sector, because often these are companies that may have difficulty getting money from banks or other financial intermediaries, and so they're able to pick up financing from government Crown Corporations. And by the way, there's not just the ones at the federal level, there's also some provincial ones, yep, like Alberta Treasury Vents, APV in Alberta. And so I think one of the interesting questions, and I think this is an important one to watch, and I think you're correct to doing that, is what additional risks right now are these Crown Corporations taking on, like CMHC? And what does that mean if there are going to be difficulties in terms of additional bankruptcies or liquidations that might occur? You know, right now, with all the money that's being spent by governments, the Bank of Canada facilities have done a great job in supporting the economy. We also have to remember that we've had a lot of deferrals, utility deferrals and mortgage deferrals and tax deferrals, et cetera. And all that's coming due this fall.
Yeah.
And I know, especially the stories I hear in Alberta as part of the Economic Recovery Council, where, you know, there's a lot of smaller businesses that are not sure they can survive by the end of the year because once they get hit with the elimination of these deferrals, so and the ability to have cash flow. So that's why I think another lockdown, for example, I think will have a tremendous impact on this economy. I think that, I think we have to watch these risks.
Okay, Elizabeth, I'm going to come back to you afterwards for your second question. I just want to get some others in here. So Bernie Etzinger, who has a question he submitted by chat. I don't know if you can turn your sound on. And you have a question about the GST that you can put to Mr. Dodge, to Dr. Dodge.
Hi, Dr. Dodge. My question is really, we introduced the GST 20 years ago as a replacement for the manufacturer sales tax, right? You talked about the cost of, I remember very much what you were saying at the time about, how it embedded costs into production and it reduced our productivity. And then when I look at the carbon tax, I feel effectively we kind of are redoing the manufacturer sales tax. So instead of liberating production, we're in fact constraining it through embedded prices that, I would think are also somehow embedded in our exports. And so we've kind of ended up in the worst of both worlds. We're now taxing consumption and taxing production. Now, just to be curious as to your views as to whether there's a different way or if this is the only way.
Yeah. So I think both Jack and I favor either carbon tax or cap and trade as a way of providing the incentive to the oil and gas industry and to, not the oil and gas, to people's use of oil and gas, because it is simple, predictable, and straightforward. So it's not because we love taxation here. It's that if we're looking for a simple, straightforward, predictable mechanism to incent lesser use of fossil fuel in consumption, and to tip the investment towards those firms that produce fossil fuel with the least amount, relatively least amount of greenhouse gases, then it's a simple way to do it. So I don't think we look at it, certainly I don't look at it as a wonderful way to raise revenues. It really is a sensible way to provide incentives to the sector and to you and me as consumers, as opposed to a whole bunch of complex regulation which keeps changing, which simply discourages investment and means that the consumer doesn't know what to do and doesn't pay attention.
Yeah, I'm just going to add one point, which we haven't talked about. And, as these carbon prices go up, and whether they're implicit prices like associated with the clean fuel standard, $350 a ton, or if it's carbon taxes or prices themselves, one of the big issues we have to think about is how do we treat imports coming into the country from those countries, particularly China and India and Asia, that generally where there is very little carbon pricing, or certainly carbon policies that are not actually having an impact. Now, let me give you a perfectly good example. There's a Quebec company that talked to me about solar panel manufacturing, which they do. But we are importing all our panels from China, and they're built with coal energy. And in fact, the emissions associated with those are so significant that we really don't get the benefit of reducing worldwide emissions by building up solar energy in Canada with panels coming from China. In other words, we are not accomplishing the objective we think we are doing. In fact, I always get tired of hearing the word zero emission cars, because we know that cars that are electric are not zero emission. In fact, they are built with batteries and they're built with parts that had emissions associated with them to build them. And of course, it also depends where you bring the electricity from and how much emissions are associated with that. But my point is that we're going to have to start worrying about tariffs. as we increase prices. Otherwise, we are going to be shooting ourselves in the foot with tough carbon pricing or tough carbon policies, and yet we end up driving importation coming into Canada from countries where there's much looser policies. And that's why I've been of the view that we should really think about harmonization with other countries, and we have to think about carbon policies when it comes to import tariffs.
All right, we have a question which I think both of you have touched on, which is protecting and benefiting from our own intellectual property more, and I think you both raised that. We also have just a question here, which I'm going to translate for you here, which is, do you even want to hazard a guess here on what you know now and of the past economic downturns, 2008, 2009? Do you think this is going to be worse, or are we smarter? Can we manage it better?
Well, it is worse. It is worse. It's different. And it's very important, I think, to understand that 2007, 2008 was a classic aggregate demand issue driven by changes in on the financing side. I mean, that's essentially what it was. And we used our classic tools at that time to deal with it, right? This is not that at all. I mean, this is started fundamentally as a big supply disruption, and the supply disruption keeps ongoing because of our fears of COVID and because government is taking action on that side. So this is a totally different ball of wax in terms of how we work our way through it. The longer term effects, I think that is a very interesting one. And I guess I'll go out on a limb here, but I think for us in Canada, the longer term effect may actually be positive because it's forced us to understand how little we were doing in if you will, the digital world, in advanced economy, in terms of the use of big data. All of that we were lagging way behind. And I think this has served as a shock. So maybe, just maybe, in fact, we'll be on a higher growth trajectory coming out, even though we're at a lower level because of this big hole that got created.
Okay, Jack, some comments.
Well, I agree with David entirely. I mean, this is a supply side problem that started. And as we come out of this, even if we, and we have been addressing it so far with aggregate demand policies, basically, with all the transfer payments that are being made. But as we come out of this, I think we need supply side policies, policies that are going to be focusing on building the productive part of the economy. And I do agree digitization is a major one, but I don't think it's the only one. We have major issues involved in terms of retraining people that are not going to be able to go back to sectors that may decline. I mean, I'm not sure where the airline industry is going to go. I'm not sure where accommodation is going to go. There will be some shifts that are going to occur. People are not going to be able to go back to some of the jobs that they used to have. Some people will, but we have to have a labor market that has that ability to shift to new opportunities. And we're also going to need new technologies and adoption of new technologies in a number of areas. And that's why I think innovation is absolutely critical. So to me, the supply side is very important if we're going to come out of this with more strength. And I hope that I'd like to be optimistic like David. Being in Alberta, I could tell you it is a very entrepreneurial province. My comment about Alberta is that its biggest resource is not oil, but it's people. And so I am actually quite optimistic about Alberta growing quite a bit. Why? Because it has a tremendous entrepreneurial economy. And I could see a lot of things happening here. But we'll see.
What we say about Saskatchewan, every farmer is actually an entrepreneur because they have to invent something in the barn at 2 a.m. to solve a problem.
Exactly.
And very similar. I'd like to get, I've got a couple more questions, but I do want to get a comment on, and I'll start with you, Jack, on this, the new central banker, the new governor of the Bank of Canada. I was shocked to see in the Toronto Star the other day, they referred to him as a social justice warrior with his words, striving for equality of opportunity is the right thing to do. It's also good for growth. That we need to look for that situation where a rising tide will float all boats. It was a very hands-on, the central, a much more aggressive role for the central bank on social policy, although they have no tools to do that. Do you have any thoughts on what should be happening there?
Yeah, well, first of all, Tiff was a student of mine at Queen's University.
So did you train him well?
Economics 101, so he and I go back a very long time. I'm going to go back to a fundamental belief I have, and maybe David might have a different spin on it. But I think that one of the most important things that we did in Canada and in a number of other countries was to say that monetary policy should be focused on inflation targeting, and that fiscal policy should be associated or focused on the other objectives or goals that governments might have, whether it's unemployment, social inequality, or whatever. Because in fiscal policy, you have a lot of different instruments that you can focus on different objectives and things like that. Monetary policy has got to be focused on inflation. And personally, I don't like it when central bankers start getting into social policy and inequality issues. I'm not saying maybe, I don't know whether Chip was correctly quoted or not. Mm-hmm. Unless it has to do with the conduct of monetary policy and inflation targeting. And we do know that when you do get serious inflation occurring, and I think we have to remember that that could always happen in 5-10 years. If we don't build up supply capacity in this country, I suspect we will have higher inflation.
David?
And inflation itself has very real social consequences on people. And I've worked in enough countries around the world for the IMF and the World Bank, and I can tell you how sad it is when you see a country going into a hyperinflation or into a real serious inflationary problem. Because people on fixed incomes, which are like pensioners, they become impoverished. They're running through garbage in order just to live. And so I think that the central banker must be focused on inflation and those factors and inflation targeting and those factors that are related to inflation targeting and not stray beyond.
David?
Well, I don't know whether inflation targeting is the end of monetary policy theory, but indeed it is the one that I think is effective on both sides, right? It's effective in trying to help the economy when things are weak. It is what constrains the economy when we're starting to get inflationary pressures. And so I'm very, I believe that the continuation of that targeting is really important. But everybody has to remember that that means that when things tighten up, as they will, and will tighten up very fast unless we get our productivity up, that those rates are going to go up and government is going to have to pay the interest on it. So the independence of a central bank in that sense is very important. The last point, the problem arises when we're at the zero lower bound, when they cannot lower interest rates any further in order to get inflation back up to that target. And therein is the difficulty, because that target is a symmetric one. And if institutionally we're constrained at the bottom. And so there is a role for government to play, and we'll see this when we get the new agreement between the government and the Bank of Canada, that at the very bottom, when we're at zero interest rates, the government is going to have to do something. Other than that, the alternative is to allow the central bank to only provide digital money, so that in fact we can have very large negative real interest rates.
All right, we're beginning to wrap our session up here today, but I did promise Senator Marshall I would come back to her for a final quick point to Mr. Dodge. So go ahead and turn on your sound and ask your question.
Yeah, thanks very much, Senator Wallen. My question relates to your previous life. I think you might be able to give me some insight. We're tracking the balance sheet of the Bank of Canada and seeing a lot of growth there. So my question relates to the Government of Canada bonds, the provincial bonds, and the Treasury bills. Like, where's it going? Will that, you know, we're thinking about the speech from the throne, and it sounds like the government's going to continue its spending. So do we foresee these numbers continuing to climb? At what point in time, you know, do the numbers start to decrease, or do they ever? Like, how does the Bank of Canada clean off its balance sheet, or will it ever, or what's the risk there? Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Well, the Bank of Canada performs a couple of roles here. The first role is to stabilize markets. And so what you will have seen is that their purchases of both bills and bonds and provincial short-term securities and public and private short-term securities, that rose dramatically. That will tail off and is in fact tailing off as we get past that stabilization of financial markets role that the bank has. The bank has the second role, and that role was the one we were just discussing, and that is to try get inflation back up close to target, because that target is two-sided, a two-sided one, and inflation too low for too long a period of time is stopped. And so in order to do that, the bank has a couple of tools. One tool, of course, is the overnight rate, but the other is the amount of bonds that it purchases to hold down longer term rates. And so that is indeed what the bank has been doing, and you can see that shift in its balance sheet that has taken place over the course of the summer, including the stabilization of the overall amount. So as indeed we begin to get a recovery, the natural thing will be for the, as inflation moves up, for the Bank of Canada to begin to shrink those bonds. And that's why, going back to the point we were making just a little bit earlier, independence of the central bank is important, and that it will move in order to choke off inflation pressures down the line as they grow. And then the balance sheet will shrink.
A final quick word to you, Dr. Mintz.
Oh, no, I don't think I have much more to add. That was a pretty complete answer that David gave.
All right. This wraps up our session. I want to thank you both so much. You've been generous with your time, Dr. Jack Mintz, who is a fellow with the Public Policy School at the University of Calgary, and Dr. David Dodge, of course, the former chair of the governor of the Bank of Canada and currently a senior advisor with law firm Bennett Jones. So you have been terrific today, and thank you. And I want to thank Greg McDougall and Steve Saunders of Government Analytics, who conceived this notion and have brought us all together here today. Thank you for your work and your ongoing work as you crunch the numbers for us all to study and contemplate. And thanks to everyone who participated. So my very best to all of you. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.